Okay, as we turn to this, really the last of the topics, other than sort of a summary topic next week, looking at aspects of our faith, and the two that I thought would be the most interesting, and actually I've seen the most literature on, is one, is there a God? How can we know that there's a God? Does science have anything to contribute to that discussion? That was last week. The other one is another core teaching of the Christian faith was the idea that death, biological death, is not the end, but there is something that lies beyond death. So, quick reminder, I just mentioned this a moment ago, but as we said last week, with the topic of God, this is speculative. This is not, you know, a pure science. So, you know, I'm thinking out loud here and just hoping this kicks around some discussion. Let's start with a fellow we know. Some of us are getting to know a little bit better on Thursday nights. In 2008, the noted theologian and New Testament scholar N.T. Wright created a firestorm. His firestorm was over how Christians view life after death. His book was called Surprised by Hope. And in that book, he suggested that the way that Christians view life after death in America and England, and even the very idea of the soul, were not biblical, and therefore were not Christian. You can understand how that stuck a stick in it and got things going. What he was advocating was that we needed to return as faithful Christians, particularly as Protestants, who say that we ground everything in Scripture, to an earlier view to express the hope that we have for life after death. To a view that he says is found in the Bible, as well as a view that is articulated in the Apostles' Creed that he as a Church of England and we as Methodists would both use. What he's referring to is the Jewish idea of the resurrection of a physical body, and then the return of that body to this physical earth at some point in future, generally understood to be kind of at the end of time. That, of course, created a firestorm. One of the reasons it created a firestorm was that what he was advocating is distinctly at odds with other parts of the Christian tradition. Just going to give you one example. The Westminster Confession, which is used within the Presbyterian Church and the Reformed tradition, which is one of the more detailed and articulate statements of faith in the period following the Reformation. Article 32, the state of humanity after death and resurrection of the dead, says this. And just mentally kind of compare this with what he's saying. The bodies of humans after death return to dust and see corruption, but their souls, which neither die nor sleep, having an immortal substance, immediately return to God who gave them. In the last day, all the dead should be raised up with the self same bodies. In other words, the exact same body, and none other, although with different qualities, which shall be united again to their souls forever. That is the kind of belief that N.T. Wright was saying is not biblical and therefore is suspect. Now, for us tonight in the series on science and faith, I want to use that little story to raise a question. And here's the question. What is the best way to articulate our core belief, which is a core belief in life after death? What images or metaphors should we use? Because one of the things that N.T. Wright was arguing is that there's some metaphors in the Bible that because they're biblical, they would take priority over other metaphors, such as the idea of a soul. Should we, for example, as he articulates and suggests and advocates, use the Jewish belief of the resurrection of a physical body? Or should we adopt the idea that's found in Platonism, And actually, the Greek philosophers actually attribute this belief earlier to the Egyptians, of the immortality of a soul, a non-physical part of us. Or should we put some type of a combination of the two together, which is exactly what we saw in the Westminster Confession? Or would we go some other direction? For example, if you go to the book of Revelation, you've got pearly gates and streets of gold, which have come down to us culturally. And for a lot of people, all jokes aside, that's kind of a mental image when we think of life after death, the idea of heaven and what that might be like. There's another question. Can contemporary science give us new tools to do this? Potentially, maybe even some better tools. So here we go. Throughout our history, Christians have consistently affirmed that death is not the end. That's one of the very core beliefs that's in every Christian denomination. Or that in God, or if, like with Paul, you're going to say in Christ, we continue to exist beyond the end of our biological lives. That when our last breath leaves us, it's not game over. However, the form that hope takes and has taken has varied and changed over time. This is one of the things that N.T. Wright was being critical of. Again, it seems that these images or these understandings have drawn on the understanding and the worldview of the culture at the time. We're going to look at this point a little bit more in a little bit here. This means that tonight I want to still really look at two things. First of all, exactly what is it that our faith means to affirm in belief in life after death? That's not as simple a thing as you might expect. Belief in life after death takes many forms, and there's multiple affirmations within that. So what are we really talking about? And then second, we need to determine whether there is anything science, possibly, might offer us in either understanding or expressing this faith. We're going to begin with the affirmation of life after death. Now, for those of you who took the life after death course and those of you who took the Apocrypha course, this is somewhat a review. For now, this is just a real quick synopsis. If the Bible is our ultimate authority, if, as we say, it's our primary source, as Protestants, we affirm that, here's what we need to know. In the Old Testament, which is about, 75 to 80% of the Bible, belief in afterlife and death is essentially missing. There is that last paragraph in the book of Daniel that seems to look at affirm resurrection of the body. And there is that little passage in chapter 2 of Isaiah, which seems to imply that there's some kind of a continuance. But essentially, Jewish faith prior to the New Testament, or at least within the Old Testament, is a belief in life in this world today, l'chaim. Not much there in terms of life after death. It's only in the period between the Testaments, and really kind of towards the end of that, around 167, 200 BCE, that we really begin to see actual beliefs in life after death start to emerge. This is found mostly in what we would call the literature of the Apocrypha. That belief in life after death emerged in Judaism. Initially, it took the form of belief in the resurrection of our physical bodies. That's what N.T. Wright was referring to. Something that would take place here on earth and at the end of time. And so we have in the literature of that period, multiple examples making that statement. It emerged during the Persian period and then going into, of course, the Greek period. But it appears that the earliest form of this was indeed in the Persian period. And it may very well reflect, and Tom, you might want to jump on this later tonight, their worldview. There's a lot of speculation that in the Zoroastrian religion, the Persians did believe that at the end of time, reality would be sort of reconstituted and there would be something like a resurrection that would happen. Is it accidental that during that period, when the, which the culture had that belief, the Jews began to have language that's similar? During this period, we also, slightly later, we begin to see some belief in the Greek idea of the immortality of the soul. The Book of the Wisdom of Solomon, for those of you who went to those courses, we saw that there. But again, the belief in immortality of the soul only was found outside Palestine in a different context, a different culture, the larger Greco-Roman world. Meaning that once again, this is one of my theses I'm developing tonight, belief in life after death was expressed in terms of the culture. The belief is part of the faith, but the way it's expressed seems to reflect the culture. In the New Testament, we only find belief in resurrection of the body, which is what surprises a lot of people. But this is basically the source of N.T. Wright's argument for what he says. The term immortal soul is not found in the New Testament. It is not found anywhere in our Bible. But in 1 Corinthians, and we'll circle back to this a couple of times tonight, Paul introduces a new concept. He has this vague reference to something called a spiritual body that is immortal. During the second century AD CE, we begin to see Christians, this is the era of the church fathers, we begin to see Christians using Paul's idea of a spiritual body as a bridge. As they shift from language of the resurrection of the body, which gradually just dies out, and we see it being replaced with language that expresses belief in the immortal soul. From the second century AD CE on, Christian belief in life after death is expressed almost exclusively in language of the soul. That's a fundamental shift. This was understood as something that would take place immediately after death. When we die, we would go to heaven and be with God. And again, that's something that you probably resonate with because that's something, the belief that we find today. This meant that as we moved out of Palestine and the world of Jewish thought, and we moved into the world of Greco-Roman thought, there was a threefold shift in how Christians expressed belief in life after death. We shifted in terms of what form life after death would take, moving from resurrection of the body to the immortal soul. We shifted in terms of when this would happen, from the end of time to the moment that we would die. And we shifted in terms of where this would be, from here on earth to in heaven. I would argue that all three of these shifts were cultural. They reflect moving from the thought world of Mesopotamia, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, that area that had dominated the Jewish world for millennia, to the Greco-Roman world located in the Mediterranean. These are two entirely different cultures. They are two entirely different thought worlds, worldviews, value systems. And as the people of faith move from one to the other, it looks like that their faith is affected by the culture that they're part of. So much so, this is a Pew Research poll done about 4 months ago. Today, the vast majority of Christians indicate that they believe in the immortality of the soul, about 72%, according to Pew Research 2020. While only about a third expect to be resurrected in the body, Pew Research 2020. And this is kind of what was behind N.T. Wright's writing of that book. He knew this. He knew that essentially the Jewish idea of resurrection of the body has basically just gone away and has been replaced by this other one. And he was, as a New Testament scholar, he was concerned about that. It is striking, and Chris, you were talking about this a little bit earlier, prior to our session tonight, but in the three modern affirmations that we use Methodism today, now we have three traditional ones. We have the Apostles' Creed, we have the Nicene Creed, we have the Athanasian Creed. These are all from the early centuries. We also have in our hymnal three modern creeds. Or they're all modern since they were all written in the 20th century. The modern creed, the Korean creed of the Methodist Church in Korea, and the new creed, which is written by the Church of Canada, United Church of Canada, of which the Methodist Church is a part. And these three modern creeds that are in our hymnal, none mention either the resurrection of the body or the soul. That is interesting. There are two things that I think are clear from the history of our faith as we think about possibly moving in the direction of science. The first is the centrality of the affirmation that our lives do not end with our biological deaths. The second is the fact that this hope has been expressed in different ways at different times in our history, and again, in different cultures. But how the hope is expressed is conditioned and expressed, it appears, in the culture of the time. So here's the premise. Today, we no longer live in the ancient world or in the culture that produced the language of resurrection or the culture and world that produced the language of the soul. We live in an age in which our understanding of reality has been shaped by and large by modern science. And this raises the question that we're going to address tonight. Is there anything within what we've learned through science that might be helpful to us in terms of either understanding or expressing our belief in life after death? Not that our belief will come from science, our belief comes from our faith, but could science possibly be helpful? In other words, can we draw on our culture and our modern worldview, or even our postmodern worldview, just as Christians in earlier ages appear to have used language and concepts of their world to help them? This may be one of the things you want to talk about later tonight. This is actually an invitation given to us by our own tradition. I referred to this briefly earlier. We began the first week of this series with a prolonged quote from Science and Faith. I want to use a smaller version of that tonight, where we have this statement. Since all truth is from God, this is essentially the two books doctrine, whether it comes from the world of science or it comes from the world of religion. If it's true, we believe it's from God. If that's true, then efforts to discern the connection between revelation and reason, between faith and science, between grace and nature, the two sides that are often played off against each other, are useful endeavors. And here it comes, in developing credible and communicable doctrine. The affirmation here is a fundamental one. Science has the potential to help us develop and communicate our faith. And so that's the challenge I want to pick up tonight. Belief in life after death is one of those areas of doctrine that science might be useful for. And ultimately, it's going to come down to each one of us whether we think this is true or not. Now, at the core of our faith is the affirmation there is something unique about us, something God-given. You see that in Genesis, you see that in Psalm 8, but we need to refine this a little bit. And that this God-given equality is something that continues beyond death. Gospel of John, my Father's house are many mansions, 1 Corinthians, if Christ be not raised, our faith be in vain. Core belief. Now, this something is most commonly known within Christian tradition. Now, we're moving from the Bible to Christian tradition as the soul. From, say, the second century on, this has been the language that our faith has used. Today, however, you'll find serious discussions more often are going to say that when we're talking about life after death, when we're talking about the soul, what we're really talking about in our own language is the idea of consciousness. This affirmation of life after death has seemed to fly, that consciousness survives biological death, has seemed to fly in the face of modern science, since there is no empirical evidence for life after death. You can find books that argue there is empirical evidence, but the science is pretty universal here. There is nothing out there that science accepts as empirical evidence for life after death. Most of what is passed off as science proof is, science would say, would be anecdotal. Until recently, the traditional scientific argument, especially from within the biological community or the community of biology, the life sciences, has been that there is nothing unique about us as human beings. That we are, and I quote, merely wires and chemicals. Wires being the neurons of the brain, and chemicals being the biochemical reactions that take place in the brain. And that everything about us as human beings can be explained biologically by wires and chemicals. It can be explained in terms of neuroscience, cognitive science, neuropharmacology, neurophysiology, neurochemistry. Of course, all these are very closely related to each other. Some within the faith community have bought into this sort of worldview that of the wires and chemicals, that it has to be something that we can prove, you know, empirically, to the point that they have tried to prove the existence of the soul. And for at least a couple hundred years, there's been numerous attempts at this. Some, you know, have tried to weigh the soul. So you may remember there was a book called 21 Grams. And the premise here was you weigh the body before death and you weigh the body after death. And the claim was the body lost 21 grams. Well, if true, then when a person dies and that last breath escapes, something that weighed 21 grams left the body. Therefore, that would be empirical evidence. In other words, that the soul would have mass, it would have weight, therefore, actually, that the soul was material. Others have sought to photograph the soul. This is back in the Victorian era, this was real popular. That under the right conditions, and you even see some shows on TV, you can be empirically observed. So we get a lot of these shows where you get these sort of images where you're not quite sure what it is, and the idea is that it's a ghost or it's a spirit or it's a soul or something like that. Now, by soul, we have normally meant two things. First of all, in modern language, it refers to the rational or conscious part of who we are, what we would refer to as the self. So we talk about souls, we're talking about our essence as a human being. Second, that this aspect of our existence that is understood to be immortal is the part that continues on with God or is going to heaven. Those are the two things that soul seems to mean. As N.T. Wright and others point out, originally our biblical hope for life beyond death was not tied to the Greek idea of the soul, but to the Hebraic idea of resurrection of the body. But as I mentioned earlier, now we're going to circle back and open this up a little bit. In 1 Corinthians, Apostle Paul spends an entire chapter talking about the hope that we have in Christ for life beyond death. This is 1 Corinthians 15. There and elsewhere, Paul seems to carefully avoid talk of the soul, likely because he knew that most people understood the soul in the Platonic sense. Well, what is that? Well, for Plato, immortality was a quality the soul inherently possessed, something in and of itself. In other words, you didn't need God for immortality. The soul was just immortal by definition. The soul always was and always will be. And for Paul, that would not do, because the soul is not immortal in and of itself. The primary concern for Paul is that we ground our hope in God's gracious love. not in some inherent equality we possess. In other words, that the hope for life after death lies with God, not with us. He's real clear about that. This raises the question whether the Christian view of who we are, our essence, must be tied to the soul. This is one of those places where now we're going to look at, are there alternatives here? Is the soul a core belief of the faith, or is it merely what is referred to as a carrier concept, a tool that is used to express a deeper truth? Obviously, soul is not the only way our hope has been expressed. We know that because we know about resurrection is another. We also know the idea that when we die, we become stars in the sky. We haven't even gotten into that, but that's actually in the Bible too. Behind the images of resurrection and immortality of soul or becoming stars lies a deeper and much more fundamental affirmation. A core belief that both resurrection and soul seek to express. A belief contemporary science may be able to help us to express. So as we get to the latter part of this presentation tonight, that's the question. You know, do we have better images than what we've had before? Two parts to this core belief. First of all, our faith in life beyond death is not based on anything that we have or possess. That's what Paul was trying to hammer home in 1 Corinthians 15. If we have any hope at all for life beyond death, it is not because of some inherent quality that you and I possess. It is because of who God is and what God can do. That's first. Second, and this is the more controversial of the two, our trust is in the Jewish God of creation and is to be fulfilled within God's creation, not an escape from it. This is why Paul affirmed that we have to have a body. Even as he says, flesh and blood, and he says this in the same book, in the same chapter, flesh and blood cannot enter the kingdom of God. So flesh and blood cannot enter the kingdom of heaven, but we're going to have a body. Interesting. And why he affirms that at the resurrection, we're going to be given a pneuma soma, a spiritual body. Even in death, Paul is saying, we remain a part of God's creation. We don't escape or fly away from God's creation. This is the basic conviction that lies behind the doctrine of the resurrection of the body. Both soul and resurrection, I believe, are vehicle concepts, not core beliefs. What is important is not the terms in and of themselves, rather it is the meaning these terms convey, the core affirmation being that our lives and the lives of those we love continue beyond death and God. Resurrection was the original vehicle of this hope, one that arose out of a Jewish context and used to convey our Christian hope. Later, resurrection was largely abandoned. We know this historically from the documents, in favor of another vehicle concept that was believed to better express our hope. And that belief was the immortality of the soul. The change occurred because it was believed that the soul was a more adequate way of expressing this core hope that we have in God. We see the change first in Paul when he talks about a body being immortal. Prior to Paul, you would never put those two terms together. And he talks about a spiritual body. Before Paul, nobody would have put those two terms together. Paul does. So in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says this, for this perishable body must put on imperishability. Notice it's not the body goes away and what survives after the body is imperishable, the body becomes imperishable. And this mortal body must put on immortality. Verse 44, it's sown as a physical body. The image here is going into the grave. It is raised a spiritual body, the resurrection. If there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual body, is his argument. Spirit and body are opposites. A spiritual body is a complete contradiction of terms in Paul's world and for most people living in the first century. This is why Paul's key term for talking about this is a word I really want to pick up as we talk about science. It is the term transformation. Again, the main point is that there are core affirmations, and then there are carrier concepts that those affirmations are expressed in. What is consistent is the core affirmation. What is subject to change is the carrier language that expresses those affirmations. So what tonight is really about is whether or not science might be helpful in carrier language, not whether science is helpful with the core affirmations. The core affirmations are faith-based. The carrier language tends to be more cultural, more worldview, and of course, we are in that scientific worldview now. Today, contemporary science may, I'm not saying it does, maybe give us better carrier language to express our Christian hope for life and God beyond death, to do so and do so in ways that make sense in terms of the way we view reality. That's really what the Book of Discipline was trying to get at, to help us to express our doctrine, our beliefs, in ways that make sense to people living in the 21st century. Recently, the core Christian affirmation that we cannot be reduced to the material or empirical, which is something we've always affirmed, has received surprising boosts from within the scientific community, and by the way, from at least a half a dozen different directions. Just as physics has been shifting from the Newtonian to the quantum view, this is just one of the examples we're going to look at, biology is experiencing a similar shift from materialism and reductionism to a more holistic view. Not every author, but within the biological community, even within, I've been doing some reading on it, even within the area of evolution, there is a striking group within that, and it's a large group and growing group that's going to argue against materialism and against reductionism, simply saying that even in terms of evolution, we cannot explain everything materialistically. We have to back out and have a bigger picture, a more holistic view of life. The reason being that the reductionism, by reductionism, I'm saying that it's only wires and chemicals. You know, we're going to reduce everything down to, you know, being human is just the biology. Being human is just the chemistry. You know, that's reductionism. That reductionism, with its attempt to explain everything human in terms of wires or chemical or DNA or the human genome, is no longer tenable. I've got a stack of books in my office, biology books, books on evolution, in which this argument is made compellingly by a large number of authors. Let me give you a few examples. The Oxford Handbook of Religion and Science. By restricting the scope of reality to the material forces shaping everyday life, that's the reductionism, the empirical method has shed no light, zero, on the great issues that face humanity, both as individuals and as a species. This is a condemnation that materialism and reductionism simply does not answer the questions we're asking. It is now widely acknowledged that materialistic explanations of who we are simply not enough. Reality requires a more nuanced understanding that can't be answered by wires and chemicals. Here is a biochemist speaking to this issue. Life cannot be reduced to the chemistry of DNA. He has a much longer argument, but this is the essence of it. Life cannot be reduced to the chemistry of DNA. It's just more complicated than that. Science also indicates that we are not just purely spiritual beings or purely physical beings. The more that we study humans and all of its dimension, what it means to be a human being, the more that we're learning that we are both physical and spiritual, however you define spiritual. This is something, again, that was affirmed in the idea of resurrection, but lost in the idea of soul. The plus side of the resurrection doctrine is it preserves physicality. What we lose with the idea of the soul is we lose the physicality and get the idea that our essence is something that can fly away. And that's what N.T. Wright was critiquing. We are not purely spiritual, ghost-like souls that exist by themselves. We are embodied. We have physicality. By the way, this is a core biblical principle, and this is one of the core beliefs of modern science. But neither are we just biology, wires, and chemicals. So this goes both ways. We are holistic, we are mind and body, and we're body and spirit. And if you follow the literature, you know this, because any textbook out there dealing with this kind of thing, unless it's just a reductionistic, purely materialistic kind of a philosophy approach, most are now acknowledging, no, it's more soul than that. These two, soul and body, personhood and body, however you want to define it, each impacts the other. Medically, you see it in strokes. Physical and mental illness, chemical imbalance, something goes wrong in the physical body, and the person that we know and we love is altered. Direct causal connection. There is no denying that they are related. There is a physicality to our spirituality, but again, we're not just reducible to physicality. What are some things that science might toss into the conversation here? You know, let's get some stuff out of the way. Probably it's not helpful first. Some people point, and this has actually come out some of our discussions, to new possibilities given to us by contemporary science. For example, the boundaries of science, particularly intriguing. Dark energy is 75% of the universe. Dark matter is 21% of the universe. 4% is normal matter. And by the way, by that would be matter and energy. So dark matter and dark energy mean that we don't know, that we cannot even detect 96% of the universe, okay? String theory postulates that at least at the quantum level, there may be extra dimensions other than the four that we experience. M theory, as you know, postulates the possibility of multiple universes. These kinds of thoughts have intrigued some within the faith community. And some people have jumped on this as saying, well, these might be possible ways for understanding alternative ways of expressing our traditional hope. That there is another where, whether it's in dark matter, dark energy, whether it's in other dimensions, whether it's in other universes, there's another place beyond what we perceive, an alternative, one guy called it an alternative geography of heaven. You know, it's just not in our four dimensions as we experience, but it's very real and it's out there. Of course, from the faith perspective, there are two problems with all this. One, it's speculative at best. Two, it is more of a God in the gaps argument or a heaven in the gaps argument, which is very, very dangerous because science is pushing those gaps back. But what it does do, that kind of thinking, if nothing else, it can be helpful in this sense. It can serve to remind us, don't be too cocky about what we know or don't know, because what we don't know is more than what we know about what can or cannot be real. One area in which science may be useful to us lies in the area of relativity as well as quantum physics. Those two grand theories about the universe, relativity being the theory of the large, quantum being the theory of the small. Of course, the grand hope is at some point we will unite these two together and therefore we'll understand all of the universe. These, relativity and quantum physics, uniquely seem to offer new ways of understanding and articulating some of our basic commitments. Not saying it works, but here's some stuff to throw against the wall, including giving us ways to conceptualize and talk about how our existence might go beyond death. We now know, for example, that neither matter nor energy can cease to exist. In the universe, this is hard science, nothing ceases to exist. It can change form. It may move from matter to energy or energy to matter, but nothing is lost. Nothing goes away. In fact, matter and energy are two aspects of the same unified reality of space-time. So much so that they now refer to, matter, modern physics, you'll hear, energy in the form of matter. The math of relativity, the math of string theory, the math of loop quantum gravity, all indicate that all of reality is energy. At the simple version, you remember E equals mc squared. Well, remember the equal sign. Energy is matter, matter is energy. And the idea that all of reality is nothing but energy is an interesting one. Let's go all the way back 2nd century BC to the Apocrypha. Actually, it's not even the Apocrypha, the Book of Enoch. There's that tantalizing vision in Enoch. It's the first time in literature we have a sort of, you might call it a tour of heaven. Enoch is taken up into heaven and sees God and sees the spiritual realm. What's particularly interesting about his vision, this is the earliest one. This is long before Dante and all of that, but it's somewhat based on, or those are based on this. Heaven is made of energy. Enoch 14. In the vision, the winds were causing me to fly and rushing me high up into heaven. And I came into the tongues of fire and drew near to a great house where God dwells. And I entered into the house, and everything was built with tongues of fire. And flaming fire surrounded the walls, and its gates were burning with fire. As for its floor, it was of fire. And above it was lightning and the path of the stars. And as for the ceiling, it was flaming fire. From beneath the throne of God, there issues streams of flaming fire. And the great glory God was sitting upon it. As for his gown, which was shining more brightly than the sun, it was whiter than any snow, and no one of the flesh can see him. The flaming fire was all around him, and a great fire stood before him. What I find particularly fascinating about that is that the earliest depiction we have of the spiritual realm is essentially a depiction of everything only being energy. And of course, some of the cutting edge of modern physics would basically say that is actually what the universe is. It's essentially interesting. Doesn't prove anything. It is absolutely fascinating. In the world of quantum reality, the world of the small, nothing ever truly ceases to exist. That's actually true in the macro world as well. It's merely changed or transformed from one form to another. By the way, this is strikingly similar, again, to an image that Paul uses to describe what will happen in life after death. John Polkinghorne, some of you may know up, is one of the ones who picks up on this. John Polkinghorne is both a physicist, in the realm of quantum physics, and he's also an ordained minister in the Church of England. And he does a lot of connecting of the two together. Look at this image from 1 Corinthians. Listen, I will tell you a mystery. We will not all die, but we will all be changed. Philippians, he will transform the body of our humiliation, our physical body, so that it may be conformed to the body of his glory by the power that also enables him to make all things subject to himself. When Paul wants to talk about the transfer, the transition from the life as we know it now to whatever life lies beyond, his language, his metaphor is transformation. In addition, according to quantum physics, everything is one. Energy, matter, wave, particle, time, space, relativity, everything's united. Everything is merely different aspects of one unified reality. Add to this that it is now speculated, at least in the quantum world, that consciousness exists everywhere at every level. Again, not all quantum physicists buy this, but this is one of the major trends within quantum physics. That even the universe itself, we saw some quotes when we did quantum physics, even the universe itself may be sentient. In the realm of quantum reality, consciousness is linked to physicality, collapsing the probability wave, and physicality is linked to consciousness. Another area that science might be able to contribute something as we think about this is in the area of cognitive neuroscience. The brain, the mind, the consciousness, the self, and what is it that actually makes us human? A lot of stuff being done here. One takeaway from neuroscience that we've already talked about, but let's just loop it back in again, is that consciousness cannot be divorced from physicality. Again, that's the core affirmation of the resurrection. We cannot be ourselves thought of apart from, as Paul would say, having a body, even if it's a spiritual body. And that our hope lies not in escaping from the physical universe to some other reality, a platonic soul or something, and that this hope has a physicality that is to be fulfilled within the created order. That's again a parallel between the doctrine of the resurrection and the universe as we understand it today. Ultimately, the faith issue is that we don't base our hope on what we can or cannot prove, because essentially we cannot prove any of this. Our hope, and it is a hope, is in God, which is exactly what people of faith did in ancient times when they embraced the carrier beliefs of the resurrection of the body and then later the immortality of the soul. These were based on the science of the time. The question that I think is worth looking at is whether the older images still speak to us, streets of gold, pearly gates, maybe not those so much, or whether the way that science helps us to view reality today might, have the power to speak to us more clearly. And by the way, let me back up here. There is actually a form of theology called process theology that actually has done some of this kind of work, and there are other theologies that are out there. But, are we able to pick up some of this new understanding? We're going to end my part of this next week with denial of science and science of denial. But